Well, can you believe it? This episode is the first in the 2000s. Yes, this podcast has been alive for a couple of years, and we're now up to episode 2001. Yes, the success of Climate Conversations is down to many people, primarily those who volunteered to be interviewed. And of course, to you, the listener, thank you. I appreciate your loyalty. It's wonderful. However, that's enough of that sentimental stuff. Let's get on to the real issue of talking about and reporting on what's the real issue, and that's climate change. And to do that, I'll welcome you to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen land of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to elders, past, present and emerging. Let's hear now from Nadia Sitaram, who's a climate adaptation expert from the Columbia Climate School, where she's a postdoctoral research scientist. She studies how sea level rises affect coastal communities. Nadia is especially interested in how climate risks are impacting housing infrastructure and housing needs. Here she discusses her efforts to understand how local and federal agencies are integrating these risks into urban planning and development.
So I'm a climate adaptation scientist, so I study the ways in which society is adapting to climate change. Really broadly speaking, I study the way that coastal communities are impacted by sea level rise. I'm really focused on the way that climate risks are interacting with housing and housing needs especially. A technical report that came out in 2022 that was a multi-agency effort stated that, well, for the next 30 years, we anticipate that sea levels will continue to rise. Major floods will occur 5 times as more often in 2050 than they do today. And so I'm more or less just trying to get a sort of, you know, baseline assessment of how everyone from local to federal actors, to urban planners, to mortgage lenders, to real estate developers are really thinking about integrating climate risks into their plans for housing. People are on the move, and people will be on the move increasingly with climate in mind. Right now, we're living in a moment where housing is undersupplied. It's really unaffordable for so many people, whether they're buying or renting. And if you're trying to solve this sort of like climate and society problem, you really just have to keep thinking about all the different ways in which climate is interacting with society. And I will give you the example of someone that I interviewed in Miami-Dade who stuck with me for a really long time. She was someone who experienced flooding on the regular because of just rainfall. And she said that, you know, you just feel really trapped here because even if you want to move, there are no other affordable options. So you're kind of trapped physically by floodwater, but then also trapped sort of economically because there aren't other options and other areas for you to move to. People who have more resources will inevitably be able to move to safer areas, whereas people who have fewer resources end up really trapped in these situations. You know, just in thinking about sea level rise, we're talking about questions that are like deeply political. Stakeholders of all sorts and sizes have different, you know, opinions on what a community should look like in the future. We shouldn't be thinking through these challenges in a reactive mode that almost ensures that we will have unequal societal outcomes. So we have to do this proactively. I think even beyond just like me as a scientist, I think me as a person is, I guess, more how I'd like to think about this. I'm planning to live on this planet for a few more decades, and so this is really a problem that we have to live with, and this is the challenge of this time. And unfortunately, it will just, you know, keep getting passed down if we don't act now.
You are listening to an audio version of a story from The Conversation.
Carbon removal is needed to achieve net zero, but has its own climate risks. The lead author of this article is Kirsten Zickfeld, Distinguished Professor of Climate Science, Simon Fraser University. For a list of the other co-authors, please refer to your screen. Narrated by Ad Oris. This story was originally published on December 6, 2023.
As delegates gather in Dubai at the COP28 climate conference with the aim to ratchet up ambition towards meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement, a key component of these efforts are countries' pledges to achieve net zero emissions around mid-century. Net zero carbon dioxide, CO2, emissions refers to a balance between CO2 emissions into the atmosphere and CO2 removals from the atmosphere, such that the net effect on CO2 levels in the atmosphere is zero. It is often assumed that if such a balance is achieved, the net effect on climate would also be zero. However, in a recent paper in Nature Climate Change, we show that unless we consider a number of other factors such as permanence of carbon stored in vegetation and soils, changes in the reflectivity of landscapes and the full suite of greenhouse gases emitted, balancing CO2 emissions with removals will not achieve the intended climate goal. Carbon dioxide removal, CDR, refers to human activities that deliberately remove carbon dioxide, CO2, from the atmosphere. CDR can leverage either natural or technological systems, though in either case, it must be additional to the CO2 removal that is driven by passive carbon sinks already at work, such as existing forests. Examples of CDR include planting trees on previously deforested or unforested lands, producing bioenergy and capturing and storing the emitted carbon, fertilizing the ocean to stimulate biological production, and capturing CO2 directly from the air through chemical and technological means. For CDR to balance the climate effects of CO2 emissions from fossil fuel burning, it needs to result in permanent carbon storage, meaning that the carbon must remain undisturbed for centuries to millennia. However, carbon stored in trees is vulnerable to natural disturbances such as droughts, wildfires, insect outbreaks, and other biotic disturbances, and could be re-released much sooner. Carbon sequestered and stored in seagrass meadows or mangrove forests, for example, is re-released following marine heat waves. Any reversals in land use and management decisions can also affect the permanence of carbon stored by CDR. Several CDR approaches, when deployed at a large scale, affect fluxes of energy and water at the Earth's surface, resulting in so-called, quote, biogeophysical, unquote, effects on climate that are in addition to the effects of CO2 sequestration. For example, large-scale planting of trees in agricultural areas or grasslands results in a reduction of how well the land surface is able to reflect sunlight, and therefore leading to a warming effect. This effect is particularly strong in regions with seasonal snow cover, where the darker color of trees reduces the high reflectivity of snow. Deployment of a range of CDR methods can also result in increased emissions of nitrous oxide and methane, two powerful greenhouse gases. For instance, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage and reforestation require the use of nitrogen fertilizers, which enhances nitrous oxide emissions. Restoration of coastal ecosystems, such as seagrass meadows or mangrove forests, can also result in an increase in methane and nitrous oxide emissions. Because of the potential impermanence of carbon stored by CDR and biogeophysical and other greenhouse gas effects, balancing emissions of CO2 with CDR might not always result in the intended climate outcome. For example, balancing fossil fuel emissions with CO2 removal through large-scale reforestation can result in a higher global warming compared to a case where the fossil fuel emissions are eliminated. This asymmetry could lead to exceeding temperature limits set by the Paris Agreement. For the reasons above, greenhouse gas accounting and policies designed to offset greenhouse gas emissions need to consider the full suite of climate effects of the proposed CDR to ensure intended climate goals are not compromised. CDR approaches with short carbon storage timescales or at high risk of natural and/or anthropogenic disturbance, like in fire-prone regions, should not be used to balance fossil fuel CO2 emissions. For carbon removal that targets carbon stores at lower risks of disturbance, it is crucial that net zero protocols also require an excess amount of CDR as an insurance in the event of carbon losses. Similarly, CDR approaches that result in biogeophysical effects or release gases such as methane and nitrous oxide upon deployment risk fully negating the climate benefit of carbon sequestration and should be excluded as a means of balancing fossil fuel CO2 emissions. In cases where biogeophysical effects or the release of GHGs partly counter the climate benefit of carbon sequestration, an additional amount of CDR is also required to compensate these effects. The measures used to establish equivalency between CO2 emissions and removals, and biogeophysical and GHG effects, need to be rigorous and grounded in science. Nature-based climate solutions that are not suitable for balancing fossil fuel emissions because of a high risk of carbon losses and/or large biophysical or GHG effects may still be appropriate to deploy because of benefits other than climate change mitigation. That includes preserving or restoring biodiversity and increasing the resilience of landscapes. If deployed in addition rather than as an alternative to fossil fuel emission reductions, these solutions can still have climate benefits, even if relatively temporary. Carbon dioxide removal will be needed to balance emissions that are difficult to eliminate and increase the odds of meeting the Paris Agreement climate goal. However, while CDR can play a crucial role in climate change mitigation, the current uncertainty around its full effects underscores the need to prioritize reducing emissions as rapidly and as much as possible.
Courtesy of UAL Climate Connections, we now have three 90-second segments.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. The U.S. has more than 600,000 bridges, and they're not made to last forever.
They're designed for a specific amount of time, usually 75 years. That's a typical design service life for bridges.
Hossam Mahmoud is a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Colorado State University. He says elements of a bridge, from footings and foundations to beams and girders, are expected to deteriorate over time. And he says climate change can accelerate that process. Rising seas and heavy precipitation can cause corrosion. Extreme heat can cause materials to expand beyond what they're designed for, contributing to buckling or cracking. Increasing carbon pollution can even alter the pH of concrete, causing it to degrade faster. Mahmoud says in most cases, these risks will not cause a bridge to suddenly collapse.
We're talking about general deterioration over time that we're able to observe and we're able to address.
But he says managing the problem will require more money and resources for inspections and maintenance. And incorporating data on climate change could help prioritize funding for those bridges in the most urgent need of repairs or replacement. As a growing number of states legalize marijuana, cannabis businesses are ramping up. But cannabis is often grown in indoor farms under intense grow lights, and this setup can have a large carbon footprint.
Indoor grown cannabis is using just a ton of electricity.
Jason Quinn of Colorado State University co-authored a study on how much energy it would take to grow cannabis indoors at various locations in each state, and the carbon pollution that would cause. The researchers found that in general, production is less polluting in areas with more clean power on the grid, and in mild climates where less energy is needed to maintain a farm's temperature and humidity. In the worst case, growing just 1 kilogram could emit as much carbon pollution as burning more than 500 gallons of gasoline. But in Long Beach, California, it would emit less than half that.
One of the challenges with it being federally regulated is that you can't transport cannabis across state lines.
But the study suggests that one way to reduce the industry's climate impact would be to concentrate farms in optimal growing areas. And when possible, avoid artificial lights and heat entirely.
The easiest thing you can do is just grow it outside.
As spring arrives, so does a higher risk of floods from heavy rain. And every year, dozens of U.S. residents die in flood disasters. To stay safe during a flood, the most important thing to do is keep far away from the water. Stay tuned for warnings and evacuation alerts, and if an evacuation order is given, try to disconnect your utilities and appliances before leaving for higher ground. If you're driving and encounter a flooded road, do not try to drive through it. Most flood deaths in the U.S. occur in cars. If you're at home and water starts pouring into a lower level, move upstairs right away, especially if the water is high enough to reach the electrical outlets. But only go onto the roof if there is nowhere else to go. And to prevent becoming trapped, never go into a closed attic. Floodwaters can hide sharp objects, contain toxic chemicals, or cover downed power lines. So it's important not to wade in the water even when it's calm. As the climate keeps warming, many areas will likely see more flooding due to stronger hurricanes and more extreme rain. So everyone should know how to keep themselves and their family safe before a flood arrives. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Here's a grab from a recent meeting of the National Press Club by mining and renewable energy magnate Andrew Twiggy Forrest. And you'll find the link for the actual presentation in the show notes. This was taken from an ABC story that had the headline, Andrew Forrest slams fossil fuel industry and coalition for nuclear energy bull dust. The story is written by Michael Jander.
Oh, look, I would love to build it here. We have to go first to prove this industry, get it up and going as quickly as possible, where the economics are best. There's a $3 tax credit, which people confuse as a subsidy, being offered in the United States for green hydrogen. Let's just break that down. It's a tax credit which doesn't exist on a profit which doesn't exist in an industry which doesn't yet exist, which North America, like Australia, badly needs to come into existence. So it's a really clever economic multiplier. It's a really clever investment engine. It's been responsible for huge inflows, the biggest in decades, into the North American economy. Adopting it here, I think, makes common sense because it's not coming out of the punter's pocket, because it's being paid as a future credit on a future profit on a future industry which doesn't even exist yet.
And so does that mean that the government's hydrogen Head Start program, in your view, is simply insufficient?
Look, I think the hydrogen Head Start program is great. Exactly as it says, it's a great start. I would say two truths can exist in the one place here. It's a really good policy, but let's rock and roll and really get green hydrogen going.
You say renewables investment fell 35% in Australia last year. Is a carbon solutions levy and a climate trigger for new energy projects enough to turn that around and quickly?
I think it will drive major change. Apart from raising $100 billion to go into the Australian economy, to go into mums and dads and farmers which are being impacted by very high energy costs caused by unreliable fossil fuel, I think it's a very, very good start. So, yes, I'm totally in favour of a climate trigger coming into projects. Those countries who have been forward-leaning on the climate are those countries who have had the strongest economies. I want Australia to be one of those, one of the strongest economies in the world. Great for every Australian.
How concerned are you by today's news poll in The Australian showing 55% of all Australian voters support the idea of small modular nuclear reactors as a replacement technology for coal-fired power?
Oh, look, it's exactly how I would vote too if I wasn't told anything about it. If I was just asked, what do you think of small nuclear reactors? And you weren't told, oh, by the way, they're totally experimental, they don't exist, you weren't told your cost of power will go up by 400%. Plus, if you're not told any of that, then you'll say, yeah, good idea. So I'd say to all politicians who are peddling nuclear, just say, hey, it'll be with us in 10 to 20 years' time, which means you're going to be stuck with fossil fuel for the next decade or two. And by the way, you'll be paying four times or five times more for your energy than the bloke next door who's on renewable energy. Is it now really a good idea? I mean, I think if we ask the question with the facts, we'll get a totally different answer.
Why do you believe the opposition is leaning towards a policy including nuclear energy? And do you see it changing votes?
Look, I think they're leaning that way because we're a bit short of answers here. Apparently, the Labor Party owns the renewable energy space. I'd say to all my friends in the Liberal National Party, no one owns this space. It's the right space. So let's both get after renewable energy. Let's lean forward as much as you can on renewable energy. But to bring up an old dog trying to teach it a new trick, like nuclear, when that technology's been out forever, when we know how much it's going to cost over renewables, four to five times, and also know that those countries who have adopted, because they have no choice, they don't have the sun, they don't have the wind, like France, they're putting up with the fact that their nuclear energy is going up every single year it was ever brought in. And of course, green energy has gone down in cost every single year ever been brought in. But they do it because they have to, not because they want to. So let's be clear. We have the choice of renewable energy. They don't. Let's go for renewable energy.
The current renewables transition plan requires a bigger buy-in from farmers and rural communities. Can you understand why there has been some reluctance up until this point?
Look, I'm a bloke from the bush. I grew up in the scrub. I really know how the community works, and I'd say absolutely, we need to recognise it's not just the cockies who are getting the best crop, most reliable drought-resistant crop they'll ever have, which is having a wind farm on their properties. It also impacts other farmers through transmission lines, and infrastructure for the national good has priority. So I would say, yes, we need to compensate not just the cockies who generate the electricity, but also the cockies who are impacted by transmission lines. Don't use that as to create a point of division in our community. That's just politics. That's putting Australia back. That's going to cost the Australian taxpayer and every Australian mum and dad a lot more through these squabbles and not just getting on with it. Let's sit down in a room, sort out these problems. They can be fixed, and not turn them into community divisions when we know we can fix them.
You're very keen that decisions are made in the interests of the next generation. To what extent should the rights of today's farmers be overridden if they're unsupportive of a rollout of transmission infrastructure on their land?
I don't think the rights of farmers should ever be overridden, let's be clear. And they are not in opposition to the rights of our future generation. They are aligned. If farmers are told that a nuclear solution is an economic and feasible solution without any facts, any figures, they're entitled to believe it. But I'd say not to the cockies, but to the politicians. Tell the full truth. The worst lie in the world is the half-truth. Tell the full truth. Yes, nuclear is possible in 10 to 20 years. Yes, it's going to cost you 4 to 5 times more. Is it still a good idea? The cocks will say, oh, that's crap. We didn't know that. Thanks for that information, mate.
But in terms of the renewable rollout, the rollout of transmission infrastructure that is proving controversial in some bush areas, should the rights of today's farmers be overridden if they're unsupportive? Should their land be resumed, for instance? How far should that go?
Look, you're talking to a cocky who's had land expropriated from our station, which has been in the family name for many generations. Land was just taken off us. We were given the market value of the land. That wasn't much for compensation. And so I do think that cockies who have transmission lines across their country deserve a right to be able to discuss that and have a reasonable compensation.
On nickel, Australia's nickel sector is in the doldrums right now. Was it a bad idea for Wyloo Metals to purchase Mincor's 3 nickel mines last year?
Look, I think we're all very wise in hindsight. And all I can say is I'm glad we did that. We will be producing and have been producing what's known as clean nickel, while companies like Tesla and others turn a blind eye to the fact that the nickel they're buying is very dirty nickel. It's been created through new coal-fired power stations. It's destroying entire rainforests. It is destroying entire marine environments because toxic waste is getting dumped into the ocean sea, and no worries. Actually, that worries Australians. That worries the global consumer as well. So we need to make a distinction. What is dirty strategic metals like nickel, and what is clean like Australia? While we don't differentiate between those two, Volkswagen, Audi, Tesla, who are just drawing nickel from very dirty sources, need to come clean and say to their punters, hey, you're not actually helping the environment buying a Tesla at all. We destroyed rainforests, we destroyed marine environments to get this super cheap nickel in. Did you know that? And they'll say, nah, that makes a difference.
But a decision has been made to place those mines into care and maintenance. When are you likely to be developing that clean nickel?
That really depends, say, in Canada on the government. And as soon as they become economic in Australia, we'll go straight into it. Then what we're pushing for is an understanding across the world, which is happening, that there's a big difference between dirty commodities and clean commodities. And if the consumer or the politician wants to make the same mistake, say Angela Merkel of Germany several years ago, when she hooked her entire economic future and star onto the Russian gas supply base and got completely carted out, cost the German economy trillions of dollars when Putin turned against them, when Putin used fossil fuel as a weapon, then you'd know, well, we have to open up our supply chains. Now, if you don't want your supply chains just to go back to dirty sources, cheap sources of nickel, where human rights, environment and green energy aren't taken into account, then don't complain about it in the future. If you want supply chains which are diversified and come from all over the world, then you're back in human rights, you're back in the environment, and you're back in green energy. And then we can all compete on a fair and equal basis.
And so if you believe that this is a structural problem facing Australia's domestic nickel sector, do you support an industry call for support to help the industry get through this time? And is that something that, that Wyloo Metals would take advantage on, if available?
Look, whatever Wyloo does, it's up to Wyloo. What I can say is I'm putting out an industry call, a global call, that we've got to allow consumers a choice. Dirty nickel will be all that there will be if we don't respect human rights, if we don't respect the environment, and if we don't respect pollution-free energy. So that's where we're all going to go if that's what we want. I'm saying that's actually not what we want. We learnt that lesson hard with Putin, who used it against Germany. Let's not get sucked into it again. Let's have diversified supply chains.
Dr. Forrest, considering the passion with which you have delivered your remarks today, do you believe Australia has lost its way in the energy transition?
Look, I think if you look at Australia from outside, all the squabbling, all the infighting, all the misinformation, all the creating of divisions is putting Australia back. While other countries are moving forward at speed, by all this squabbling and bickering, we're actually getting smoked. There is no choice here. Green energy is the lowest cost of energy into every Australian household. It's going to happen anyway. Green energy will not destroy the environment. Fossil fuel will continue to be unreliable, expensive, be used as a weapon, and cost more to every Australian household. So we know it's going to happen. Can we just stop all the bickering and politicking and get on with it?
Andrew Forrest, thank you for your time.
And thank you, Kirsten. I've really enjoyed being on.
Here now is the audio from a story from the Melbourne Age with the headline, "The Victorian Towns where Peter Dutton is considering going nuclear." The story is by Josh Gordon and Benjamin Priest.
The Coalition is leaving the door open to building nuclear reactors in the Latrobe Valley and Anglesey using land from retired coal-fired power stations as a solution to Victoria's energy troubles. But locals warn there would be significant opposition to nuclear reactors being built in their towns, even if the huge legal hurdles to constructing and running them could be overcome. With Victoria's energy security under scrutiny after a wildstorm earlier this month left hundreds of thousands of homes without power and triggered the shutdown of the state's largest coal-fired generator, the federal opposition has confirmed it is now in the advanced stages of developing an energy policy. Nuclear is set to be a key part of the mix. Opposition energy spokesman Ted O'Brien told The Age potential locations remained a work in progress, but he had been advised that communities with experience hosting coal plants could be ideal potential hosts for zero-emissions nuclear plants. That leaves Victoria's three remaining coal-fired power plants, plus the now decommissioned site of the Hazelwood Mine and Power Station, as strongly preferred locations, with existing connections to the energy grid, and a ready-made workforce preparing for the end of coal-fired generation over the next 15 years. "We have been very transparent about the fact we are considering zero-emissions nuclear energy as part of Australia's future energy mix, and we will remain open about the details of our policy when it is announced," O'Brien said. The state opposition remains more cautious about the prospect of nuclear in the Latrobe Valley, but it too is not ruling out the idea. Asked about using retired coal-fired power stations as sites for nuclear energy, opposition leader John Pesutto said a common-sense approach was needed. But for any new industry to succeed, it would first need detailed inquiries and thorough examination, Pesutto told The Age. It would also require bipartisan support, as this is crucial for investment certainty and to eliminate sovereign risk. Other sites in Victoria have also been flagged. Federal opposition leader Peter Dutton recently hinted at the possibility of a small modular reactor on the Surf Coast at Anglesey, on the site of Alcoa's former mine and power station. It's zero emissions, you can put it into an existing brownfield site, so when the coal-fired generation comes to an end, you can put the nuclear modular reactors into that facility, Dutton said in September. The argument for nuclear is that plugging into existing infrastructure would be significantly cheaper and would reduce the need for thousands of kilometers of new transmission lines needed to connect wind and solar energy dotted across the grid. O'Brien has previously pointed to a September 2022 study for the U.S. Department of Energy that found using the infrastructure of an existing coal plant could reduce a nuclear plant's capital costs by up to 35%. He suggested Australia should look to the U.S. state of Wyoming, which is planning to replace its coal-fired generators with nuclear by about 2030. But any move towards nuclear power in Victoria would likely encounter strong resistance from communities worried about safety, waste disposal and the cost. Voices of the Valley President Wendy Farmer said nuclear power would face major opposition from communities worried about the risks. Farmer said residents in the Latrobe Valley had already suffered the consequences of the Hazelwood mine fire in 2014, which burned for 45 days and caused health concerns for those living amid the smoke. Although Australia mines and exports uranium, which is used to produce nuclear power, both Victorian and national laws ban the domestic operation of nuclear power generation. Surf Coast Shire Mayor Liz Patterson said her council had not consulted the community about nuclear power, but she doubted whether Anglesey would accept a reactor in the region, especially so close to the ocean. "I would be surprised if there would be any enthusiasm for a reactor," she said. Deputy Mayor Mike Bodsworth, who represents the Anglesey ward, said residents were excited by the potential for renewable power generation at the former Alcoa site. "But nobody I know has ever mentioned nuclear," he said. "Knowing the general preferences of the local population, I doubt it would be supported." The coalition has been talking up the potential to use small-scale modular reactors to generate power, and argue this, along with gas, will be a key part of Australia's future energy mix to provide so-called baseload generation along with variable renewables. In May last year, US company Westinghouse released plans for a small modular reactor. Reuters reported Westinghouse planned to begin building the reactor by 2030. But many experts say this approach would be prohibitively expensive in Australia, particularly if forced to compete against lower-cost renewable wind and solar generators now being installed at a rapid rate across the country. The CSIRO's best guess is that in 2030 the capital cost of a small modular reactor will be $15,844 per kilowatt of electricity generated, compared to $1,078 for solar and $1,989 for wind. That suggests replacing Victoria's three remaining coal-fired plants, which combine to produce up to 4,730 megawatts of electricity, with nuclear would involve a capital cost of about $74.9 billion, before even considering the ongoing running, maintenance and waste disposal costs. The coalition would also need to get the numbers in state parliament to repeal existing state and federal laws, including Victoria's Nuclear Activities Prohibitions Act of 1983. Which bans the construction and operation of nuclear facilities in Victoria. Victorian Energy Minister Lily D'Ambrosio said nuclear energy was toxic, risky, will take years to develop and is the most expensive form of energy there is. "Not only are the sites of our former coal plants privately owned, but there is currently no regulatory framework for approving a nuclear power plant in Australia, there are no nuclear waste storage sites in Australia, and no modular nuclear reactors have made it past the trial phase," she said. Federal Energy Minister Chris Bowen said claims of a boom in small modular reactors was a myth, and suggested Dutton should explain to the people around Gippsland why they should accommodate multiple reactors, for no good reason. "Anyone who has done their homework knows nuclear is not viable," Bowen said. The alleged boom in small modular reactors is a furphy. It's striking that a party that once prided itself on economic rationalism could embrace a frolic so spectacularly uneconomic. In the US, a project run by NuScale Power to build the first commercial small modular reactor was scrapped last year because of soaring costs, leaving taxpayers facing a significant bill. Other projects promising commercially competitive nuclear energy have similarly failed to materialize.
Now, I've been rather busy this week. I've had interviews with the CEO of Geelong Sustainability, Dan Cowdell, and Western Australian environmental campaigner, Mark Allen. And you'll find both those stories in the podcast. Now, because I've been so busy, I've somewhat ignored what's been happening in the climate change news world. And the stories have just been piling up like you wouldn't believe. So I'll put as many links as I possibly can in the show notes. So I'd urge you to go there, read them, have a look at them, and make some decisions about how you combat the climate crisis. Well, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, I'd love to hear from you. I want to know what you think about this podcast, so please contact me on r.mclean7@icloud.com. Now, don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love it if you shared this with your friends. Put it on your networks, let people know what's going on with the climate crisis, because we need everyone on board. As Naomi Klein said, to change everything, we need everyone. Also, I urge you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so if you feel like being a guest, contact me and I'll arrange to get in touch somehow. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.